യോന്തപ്രവിശ്യമമവാചമിമാം പ്രസുപ്താം സഞ്ജീവയതി അഖിലശക്തിധരസ്സുധാമ്ന അന്യാംശ്ച ഹസ്തചരണശ്രവണത്വഗാദീൻ പ്രാണാനമോ ഭഗവതേ പുരുഷായ തുഭ്യം. സോ ദി ടോപ്പിക് ടുഡേ ഈസ് വേദാന്ത ആൻഡ് ബുദ്ധിസം. സോ when you talk about Vedanta, you have to remember Vedanta as we understand today, as a compact philosophical spiritual system, did not exist during Buddha's time. But the central teachings of Vedanta were studied by Vedic scholars, Sanskrit scholars, including Buddha, who was born in a princely family. He was a prince, and in those days, members of the royal family will be naturally introduced to Vedas, Sanskrit, right from the early days. And if you look at Buddha's teachings, which are found in Pali canonical literature, the original form, a book like called it is called Arya Vinirmojana Sutra. It is Santi Vimojana means it is a It is a sutra which contains Buddha's original teachings given in Pali, spoken in Prakrit but recorded in Pali script. It is called Arya Santi Vinirmojana Sutra. Sutra means, let's say, a piece of spiritual philosophical literature. It deals with the concept of, with the idea of liberation from knots or bondage, samsara. That's the meaning of it. Arya means something noble, something that makes you spiritually enlightened. If you read that book, which of course it's not authored by anyone, it was recorded by a lineage of teachers in Buddhist tradition, in Sanskrit, he's practically is a Vedanti. So that should be kept in mind. Vedanta as a system of philosophy, it was systematized and organized with a definite metaphysic, epistemology, logical system. All these work were done by Shankaracharya in the 8th century AD, 1200 years after Buddha's passing away. So on the one hand, it's true that Buddha was a Vedanti in the sense that he had thoroughly studied the entire range of Vedic literature. At the same time, Vedanta as a system of philosophy that we understand today took shape in the 8th century AD at the time of Shankaracharya. Now, after Buddha's passing away, which happened to be 480 BC, the timeline is from 560 to 480 BC. That's Buddha's time. You have to calculate backward. Is it BC before Christ? Buddha belonged to that the particular age. Karl Jaspers called it the axial age, which is very important in the history of human civilization. That was the age which produced some of the great world movers in spirituality, philosophy, and mysticism. Confucius, Lao Tse, Buddha, the Vedic sages, at least many of them, some of them they belong to much earlier era, but many of them belong to the actual age, and some of the Hebrew prophets, pre-Christian Hebrew prophets, those who were prophets who may have lived before Christ. Now, many of them belong to this particular era. Say one modern thinker, his calculation, many of the historians in modern times do accept that view, but many of them do not, Karl Jaspers. So Buddha belonged to that actual age. It's a very celebrated age. All that you find ennobling, refining, spiritually, philosophically enlightened, even in the 21st century, had a roots in actual age. That's from 8th century BC to 2nd or 3rd century BC. You have to count backward, 500 years, 550 years, to be very precise. Now, Buddha belongs to that age. As I mentioned, he was born in 560 BC and passed away in 480 BC. In 483-85, around that time, the first Buddhist council took place. That was in Rajagriha. If you go to Bihar, Bihar state of India today, Buddhagaya, from there you travel, Rajgir is called Rajgir, or the Rajagriha, which is the capital of a celebrated dynasty which had extended its rule all the way from Samarkand, Azerbaijan, right up to Sri Lanka. So you find in Buddhist tradition, one of the very important celebrated texts is Lankavatara Sutra. It's a conversation between an enlightened person, according to some tradition, Buddha himself, a Buddhist monk, and a king called Ravana. Not the Ravana, ten-headed Ravana of the mythological times mentioned in the Ramayana. Must have been a king who lived in today's Sri Lanka. So I'm trying to give an idea of the time when Buddha lived and the time of divergence between Buddhism and Hinduism, which is actually the source of Vedanta. So in this first Buddhist council held around 483 BC in Rajagriha, he was presided by a celebrated Hindu king called King Ajatashatru, who appears in a lot of Buddhist literature. Conversations, dialogues between Buddhist monk and King Ajatashatru. Later that became well known as a Magadha Empire, which is a very celebrated empire, Kushan Empire, which as I mentioned, it included today's Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia, many parts of Central Asia, and Burma. It's a huge empire. Now, in this first council, which was presided by King Ajatashatru, and it was actively moderated by a great disciple of Buddha, Mahakashyapa, who is a great sage, very enlightened person, very celebrated name in Buddhist lineage tradition. In this council, a lot of discussions took place. Some of the Buddhist monks and some laity, members of the laity, they remembered Buddha's original teachings and they recorded in Pali script, which later on became the three baskets in English, you know, Tripitakas, three canonical traditions, Suttapitaka, Vinayapitaka, and Abhidhammapitaka. Incidentally, you know, the celebrated Dhammapada, which is a representative book in modern times of Buddhism, the most well-known book is called, those who are not Buddhist, but those who want to study something of Buddhism, for them it's best to begin by reading Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is part of Suttapitaka. Now, King Ajatashatru passed away very soon, and he was himself a Buddhist, a Hindu, and a Jain. He was a traditional Hindu, was highly attracted by Buddhism, by the personality of Buddha, and also by the teachings that he directly heard from the disciples of Buddha. And he was himself a great patron of another religion called Jainism. Jaina, for example, those who know, Gandhi was Jain. Kind of extreme non-violence, almost to a mind-boggling extent. Closing the eyes, closing the mouth, they don't want to breathe anything because they may breathe in some bacteria. They were very careful walking in the street because they don't want to stumble upon an ant. So kind of extreme non-violence. Actually, when you think of these two alternatives in modern times, extreme violence, which is that becomes the brand name of many religious traditions, and extreme non-violence, maybe a little bit of extreme non-violence is always a welcome addition to modern times. Few Jains, if there are, it'd be good for the world. So that is the kind of emphasis they gave to this idea of non-violence. So King Ajatashatru played a very important role. And in a way, he was responsible for many of the later developments that took place in Buddhism. In fact, he initiated the process of sending ambassadors, emissaries to different lands for spreading Buddhism. First, he sent some emissaries to Sri Lanka, but it worked. Later, the great emperor Ashoka the Great, who became a Buddhist, he sent his daughter to Sri Lanka, and also it said that he sent some monks to today's Tibet and China. A bit from there, later he traveled to different parts of the eastern, far eastern world. So that's why I'm trying to give a connection between Hinduism, which the source of Vedanta, and Buddhism. So Buddhism was not considered to be a distinct religion when this first Buddhist council took place. This is an important point to remember. And many of the early Buddhists who flocked into Buddhism were traditional Vedic Brahmins. After all, you know, even some of the great names in later Buddhism, either Yogacara system or Shunyavada system. Nagarjuna himself was born a Hindu, born in somewhere in South India, studied all the Vedas, went to Nalanda and established himself as a great Buddhist scholar. Asanga and Vasubandhu, the two brothers who incidentally were born in what is now partly Afghanistan, partly Pakistan, in the India-Afghan-Pakistan border. Vasubandhu and Asanga, the great celebrated names associated with Yogacara system, a Vijnanavada system. Today's mindfulness is just a distant echo of that Yogacara philosophy. So they were all celebrated Pandits in Sanskrit, but migrated to Buddhism. So you can find their book, the well-known books of Asanga and Maitreya, you know, Yogacara Bhumi Shastra. Many of these books are Trimshatika, all these books written by Vasubandhu reflect influences of some of the influences of the Vedic tradition. So this much just to give a background. Now I'm coming to the subject proper. If you look at the practice of spiritual discipline, moral discipline, ethical discipline, what you should do, what you should not do, to get enlightened in spiritual life, you find there is a surprising, not just similarity, but identity between Buddhism and traditional Vedantic Hinduism. When I talk about Vedantic Hinduism, I am using this term with a specific implication, because when you hear about Hinduism, you may see all these temples all over the world, huge temples, with so many deities, and Buddha did not worship any created god. So Buddha himself became a great god, of course. So there's a contrast, apparently. Now, if from a Vedantic perspective, all these deities whom you find in Hindu temples, all these different diverse forms of worship that associated with Hinduism are different approaches to the same one supreme reality, which is beyond name and form, which is transcendental, which is all-pervading, which is immanent, which exists in all of us as a spiritual spark. The essence of a true being is Atman or Brahman. The same idea you find in a well-known book, Tathagata Garbha idea. It's a very important idea in Yogacara Buddhism. Tathagata Garbha means, literally it implies this simple principle. Within all of you, within all of us, there is the potential to become a Buddha. Garbha means womb, the source. Tathagata means Buddha. So when we practice certain spiritual disciplines, what is happening is, this Buddhahood, the real Buddha, it is not Buddha, the prince was born in what is now Nepal. No. Buddha ideal, the Buddha, what you call Buddhahood, the essence of Buddhist enlightenment is present in all of us. That is the meaning of Tathagata Garbha. It's an important principle in Yogacara system. So actually the Lingavatara Sutra merged, put together both the Tathagata Garbha ideal and also the mainstream Yogacara system. If you are interested in this subject, at the beginning itself, I want to tell you, in the Sunday lecture, you can't give a full picture. But we are giving a series of lectures on Buddhism as part of the ongoing series of lectures on the foundational text of Indian philosophy. We already gave about 47 lectures on Advaita Vedanta, Ramanuja, Madhva, Vallabha, Nimbarka and others. And right now we have just finished discussion on Shunyavada, mostly focusing on three important works of Nagarjuna, that is Mula Madhyama Shastra, Madhyamika Karika it is called, and Vigraha Vyavartini, literally means, in English means, dispeller of all doubts, something, and Ratnavali. One is a highly dialectical, metaphysical, polemical work, Madhyamika Karika. Vigraha Vyavartini is a dialectical work, and Ratnavali is a didactic work, means instructional, advice given to a king, how you should be a philosopher king, how you can be an enlightened king by realizing the truth of Shunya. That is a discussion which is going on, that already we have done almost 20 lectures on Shunyavada. Today we are actually going to begin Yogacara system, incidentally. Now, at the practical level, Buddha said, Chattvari Arya Satyani. That's the beginning of Buddhist instruction. Four noble truths. Chattvari means four. Arya Satyani means noble truths. That is, there is such a thing as dukkha, and there is a cause for dukkha. There is a way out of it. And the way out of it is Eightfold Disciplines will take you to Nirvana. This is Buddha's ethical doctrine. So, that is Samyak Drishti, Samyak Sankalpa, Samyak Vak, Samyak Karma, Samyak Ajiva, Samyak Vyayama, Samyak Smriti, Samyak Samadhi. Proper, right view, right thinking, right way of speech, right action, and right livelihood, right effort, and right memory. That is the genesis of what you now we call mindfulness, which in its original form can be found in the classical Pali canonical work called Satyupattana Sutta and Mahasatyupattana Sutta. Buddha's discourse on how to remain perpetually in a state of awareness and also be detached from what you are aware of. Sati Upattana Sutta. Sati means Smriti, Upattana Upasthana. The Sanskrit form is Sutra, means with the statement. Now, through this, what happens? You get Nirvana. When Nirvana happens, you get out of this this samsara chakra, being born, living, dying, reborn, again continuing the same cycle. With some of the Buddhists who wrote commentaries on Patanjali Yoga Sutra, like Vijnana Bhikshu, who is a great Buddhist. Buddhist made a great contribution to three important knowledge systems in India. One is Buddhism itself, apart from Buddhism, one is Vyakarana, Sanskrit grammar. Rupavatara, which is the table to be memorized by every Sanskrit student when he's going to kindergarten, is a creation of a great Buddhist scholar, Rupavatara. To understand the funny contrast is, a traditional Hindu may learn this memorization, do memorization of these verbal forms and nominal forms by Ramaha Ramu Ramaha, means Rama, I mean just a singular, dual and plural. So Rama is a deity in Hindu tradition, but Buddhists don't accept him. They said Vriksha, Vriksha, Vriksha. I mean, one tree, two trees and multiple trees. So when Hindus study one Rama, two Rama and multiple Ramas, Buddhists didn't do that. So a Buddhist scholar formulated another work called Rupavatara, which means tree, two trees and multiple trees. Just I'll give you an example. So Buddhists believe that when you practice these eightfold disciplines, what happens is you get out of this this wheel, karma, vritti, samsara, chakram, it is called, according to Maitreya and others. Chakram is a wheel. So whatever we do, it creates an effect, a clinging, because of the desire. And that leads to a rebirth. And in the next life, we continue the same process. And this samsara, which is like, samsara literally means constant flow. Samsarati, idi samsara. Like a river, it flows. There is no end. So this endless cycle of being born, living, suffering, and enjoying, of course, and then dying and reborn. This is a problem, according to Buddhists, according to Jains, according to Hindu tradition, according to most of the religious traditions of Indian subcontinental origin, Jain Sikhism and all that. Life in this world is fine, but Buddha said there was a problem. So he called it dukkha. Dukkha never means, does not mean what we mean by the English word sorrow or grief. No, that should be a very important point to understand. Dukkha is what naturally comes to a person who understands the impermanence, the changing nature of all empirical phenomena, and then when he is not happy with that, that state of mind is called dukkha. The same word was used by Patanjali, and Patanjali says this dukkha can happen only to an enlightened person, not the Buddha, but somebody who is ready or going to be a Buddha. Even to realize that money is not everything, bank balance is not everything, a great job is not everything, there is something far beyond that. To understand this, you should be an enlightened person. A person living at the worldly level, for him, you know, food, a good cloth, good house, that's enough. Nothing more. But somebody who is enlightened, but not enlightened like Buddha, somebody who is enlightened enough to understand that this empirical worldly enjoyments are not enough, they are by the very nature imperfect. To realize this, you should be somewhat cultured and enlightened. Patanjali's commentary in Parinama, he called it Parinama Dukkha. Parinama Dukkha means a dukkha, a realization of the imperfection, incompleteness of worldly things, which has a transformative effect on you. Parinama means transformation in Sanskrit. So, a realization of the basic incompleteness or imperfection of worldly life, worldly enjoyments, that is called dukkha. So, frequently when you translate dukkha into grief, and you look at Oxford, Chambers, Webster Dictionary, you find Buddha was crying and weeping as he walked from Lumbini to Buddhagaya. You know, he was born in Nepal. Lumbini was the capital of the town of the great small kingdom where he was born. He was the prince, King Suddhodana was his father. He was brought up as a luxury loving prince. We were not allowed to see any of the negative aspects of life outside. So one day he was almost 28 years old. He had married, had a child called Rakula, who later became a great Buddhist monk himself. So Buddha was a young man. One day he was taken out to the streets of the capital city of the kingdom, and then he saw a dead body being taken to cremation ground. He saw the face, the grief-stricken face of an old man, a sick man. So old age, sickness, death. He never knew that such a thing ever existed. He never knew, the thought never came to him that it's possible for you to fall sick or to get old and to die. He was brought up in such a very secluded, overprotected background. That's because an astrologer had predicted when he was born that either he will become a king of renunciates or he will become a great emperor. And the king wanted that his son become a great emperor, all-conquering emperor, like Napoleon. That is what his father wanted, not the mendicant, not the king of mendicants, no. So he was not allowed to come in contact with anything that is negative in life, in the darker side of life. He was totally kept away from that. So one day, as I mentioned, death, old age and sickness, these dark realities of life suddenly hit him. And then he saw a sage sitting in a street corner. Face was calm and quiet, absolutely no problem. He wanted to be like him. That night he left his home, walked 1300 miles, came to Buddhagaya, very close to, still in Bihar state. Bihar played a very important role in the cultural history of India. Mithila was the origin of the Navya-Nyaya and modern logical system. Many of the great philosophers, many of the great scholars who enriched Advaita Vedanta, Vajasapati Mishra, was born in Mithila. So, Buddha went to Bodhgaya, sat under a tree, and then he took a resolve. Ikasane sushudhi mesharidam. Tugasti maamsam cha vilayam cha yadu aprapya siddhim bhagu janma durlabham naivasanath kaya matas chalishyade. He took a resolve. It is mentioned in the Buddha's biography. It belonged to 2nd century AD. It's a poetical work by Sukhosha. He says, I am going to sit under this tree with a strong determination. I won't get up from this seat, from this place, till I get the supreme enlightenment, which can be accomplished only after several life cycles of evolution. Let my body perish. Let it be reduced to bones, marrow, and blood. Tugasti maamsam cha vilayam cha yadu. Let it be reduced to bones and marrow and all that. That's Buddha's resolve. And of course he sat 543 previous life cycles flashed through his mind. And he practiced mindfulness. So that's the importance of mindfulness, which later Buddha elaborated in his discourse on Satipatthana Sutta, which was given to the laity. Sorry, Satipatthana Sutta, the shorter form, which was discourse given to monks and nuns in Buddhist tradition. And Mahasadhyupattana Sutta, the bigger version, larger version, which is a discourse addressing an assembly of householders. That is the genesis of what we call mindfulness. He himself practiced. So when he meditated on these 543 life cycles, Jataka tales, you may have heard, rebirth stories, flashed through his mind. He was not drawn towards it. He kept himself from being attached to it. At the same time, he was aware of it. So awareness and detachment, or awareness and lack of absence of attachment, is the psychological process of mindfulness. You can live in this world. You should be aware of it. If you are ignorant of it, you won't be able to practice detachment. You should be aware. At the same time, you should be detached. In fact, This is the central discipline prescribed in Vedantic tradition. A spiritually enlightened person should live in this world. He should be aware of everything. At the same time, he should be able to detach himself from everything. Bodhruttam audasinittum. You should be aware of it, but you should be non-involved in it. Then what happens is, you can get out of the samsara. That's how you attain nirvana. That is Buddha's concept of moksha. So there are certain disciplines he mentioned here. For example, future. All day you are going to be old. Then you have a desire to be born. Then you are clinging to life. All these are caused by ignorance, desire, it's called Trishna, which creates clinging to all these enjoyments, and that again gets you imprisoned, caught in this wheel, and then what happens is you are born again. So in this way one can get out of this this trap or the samsara. And Buddha said, if you practice these eightfold disciplines, you become a spiritually enlightened person. You can live in this world, but you can live with a spiritual wisdom and intelligence. In Vedanta, on the other hand, you know, there are seven disciplines prescribed in Vedanta, all according to ancient books, which Buddha also must have studied when he was a young man. It's called Sadhana Chatushtaya Sampatti and Sravana Manana Nididhyasana. It's in English. It's put in English. First, we must have the ability to discriminate, to discern what is real, what really matters, and what is relatively insignificant. And this is a very simple common sense. Even if you teach children going to school, there are many things that they may read or they may encounter, they may experience. Certain things should be dispensed with, means you should ignore. If you don't, you are not able to ignore the unnecessary or insignificant things, you won't be able to focus on what is really important, what is actually significant. So this is called Nitya Anitya Vastu Veka, the Sanskrit term, means kind of discerning wisdom that helps you to realize, to understand what is really important, what is eternal, and what is non-eternal. This is what actually a Buddhist is supposed to do when he realizes these Four Noble Truths. When he realizes that there is dukkha. Again, dukkha is not grief. There's a very, very serious misunderstanding. If you read the fundamental canons, either in Sanskrit or in Pali, and incidentally, you know, in the 13th century, 12th century AD, the great University of Nalanda was destroyed by Muhammad Bakhtiar Khilji. And he was a general, military general of Alauddin Khilji. So they destroyed entire Nalanda University. Tens of thousands of students were studying, thousands of students, including students from China. In fact, in later centuries, we could preserve some of the ancient manuscripts, which are available only torn forms, because one great man, many others, of course, Hajima Nakamura, a Japanese scholar who knew Tibetan, Pali, Sanskrit, and Chinese. Many of these great Indologists and those studied Indic studies, they retrieved many of the scriptures from Chinese script. And many of these books are still available only in Tibetan Chinese languages, because when Nalanda University was destroyed by Muhammad Bakhtiar Khilji, the entire university was destroyed. Fortunately, in the 3rd, 4th century AD, Huyen Sang, a great Chinese traveler, had come to India. He had studied, he studied Buddhism under Dignaga, who was a great name in yoga as a system, Buddhist tradition. And he studied, and he is supposed to have taken 60 camels loads of scriptures from Nalanda. Today, if you go to Google, you can see the ancient Nalanda universities. So, what I mean to say, so Buddhism had spread in so many places. Most of the great books are not available right now, but they're available only in the manuscript forms. Buddha taught through stories, by telling stories. And some of the stories are linked to his own previous life, which I mentioned, Jataka tales, rebirth stories. You can find Buddha was following an ancient tradition. In India, there were two main streams of these tales and stories. One is Panchatantra, which is written by Vishnu Sharma, born in Kashmir. Very ancient book. Buddha must have studied. It is translated into German, French and Latin right from 18th century onwards. And their later work, Kadasari Sadhira, is a more late, from a later origin. So Buddha followed this wonderful tradition. You can find sometime, you know, in the Christian tradition, the parables are good examples of teaching great spiritual truths through storytelling. So Buddha tells of his own previous life cycles. In each of this life, he was born either as a human being, sometimes even an animal, monkey. The Mahakavi story is the Jataka. When he was born as a monkey king, the monkey king sacrificed his entire life for his subjects. When he was born as a disciple of a guru, the disciple was willing to sacrifice whole life for his guru. So in each of this life, he showed this tremendous compassion, love, humanism, and equality for everyone. And his teachings were simple. At the same time, they were loaded with spiritual wisdom. About the idea of God, you have to remember, Buddha was not an atheist. He was an agnostic. In any discussion about God or Atman, Buddha mentioned, see, have you seen God? Have you parents of God? So why should you worry about something that none of you have ever seen, only heard of? So Buddha was not an atheist, but he was an agnostic. I mean, he didn't pay much attention to the idea of God. But the greatness of Buddha was a great humanist, kind of spiritual humanist. Coming to Vedanta, that is the next important step. Coming to Vedanta, you find the idea of Vedanta can be found in all the four important philosophical systems that emerged in Buddhism from 2nd, 3rd century BC onwards. And this progression, this evolution continued right up to 7th century AD. So almost 900 or maybe 9 or 10 centuries. During this period, four distinct schools of Buddhism developed. Sautrantikas and Vaibhashikas belonging to Hinayana system. Pali canonical literature is the central source of the theological doctrines. And Mahayana system is Shunyavada and Vijnanavada. Now, in these books, what you find is there is always, on the one hand, the insistence on life in this world. There is much less emphasis on something transcendental, except Nirvana idea. Now, in Hinduism, Vedanta, you call moksha. Moksha is liberation from samsara. And in Buddhism, the moksha becomes nirvana. In Shunyavada, nirvana becomes realization of Shunya. And in Yogacara system, it becomes Vijnapti Matrada Siddhi, which is actually the name of an important book. When you realize that all external objects are devoid of any reality, only ideas in our mind are real, and all these external objects are only ideas merging in our mind, they do not have independent existence. They are only ideas. It is a kind of extreme idealism which emphasizes the mental more than the physical, over the physical. In Shunyavada, Nagarjuna says, when you attain Shunyata, when you realize Shunyata, what happens is, you realize the Pratitya Samutpada. It's a technical term, I should try to explain this. Everything in this world, the entire empirical phenomenal world, the past, present and future, they are all conditioned. It's called dependent origination. That's a literal translation in English of Pratitya Samutpada. Everything is conditioned by something. In other words, nothing in this world has any intrinsic, inherent existence. Nothing in this world has any kind of inherent, permanent, intrinsic existence. This realization will help you to understand Shunya. So all the empirical phenomena are called Samvruddhi Satyam in Buddhism. Shankara called it Vyavaharika Satta. Same thing. Dvesatte Samubhasitya Buddhanam Deshasevana Loka Samvruddhi Satyam Cha Satyam Cha Paramartha. This is Madhyamika Karika Nagarjuna. Mula Madhyama Shastra. What it means is everything in this world, including empirical world, all these constitute relative, empirical things, coming and going, they do not have any independent, permanent existence. Only dependent existence. It is conditioned by something and itself becomes a cause of something else. Vedanta tells you that everything in this world only relates to you. People sometimes the wrong notion, Vedanta tells you, I am not here, you are not here. No. Vedanta only tells you that everything in this world is real only in the relative sense, not in the absolute sense. So what is the absolute reality? That is something to be experienced and cannot be explained. Nagarjuna says, to call Shunya itself is wrong. Nagarjuna's Karika, Madhyamika Karika is very interesting. You know, if you want to go crazy, you can read that. He says, Shunya is neither Shunya nor non-Shunya, I call it Shunya. Neither the combination of both nor the rejection of both. So it is something to be experienced. When you experience that, what happens is you are able to detach yourself from everything. At the same time, you are aware of it. When you realize this, you can become an enlightened king. In fact, that is, interestingly, that is a thesis in one of his well-known book. I called didactic work. It's called Ratnavali. Garland of diamonds. Garland. Great teachings. So Nagarjuna was not only a dialectician, but he also was a wonderful spiritual instructor. He's addressing a king. And he's asking the king, you realize the fundamental impermanence of everything in this world, then you'll be a philosopher king. You cannot do anything unjust, anything wrong. You'll be compassionate. You'll be kind. You'll not be greedy. You'll not try to conquer all places around you, because everything in this world is relative, impermanent. But that is called Loka Samvruddhi, or we may call it Praditya Samutpada. And that's what happens when you realize Shunyata, Ekuri Nagarjuna. In Vedantism, what it means is, when you become philosopher king, you understand all these things are, well, they are only relative, they are only vyavakarika. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there is an interesting dialogue between a great woman dialectician, scholar, who challenges all the scholars, and including the king and emperor, in the assembly for an argument. Gargi, that's the name. And then she enters into a prolonged discussion and debate with another great scholar, Yajnavalkya. This is one of the celebrated episodes in the Vedic literature, which Buddha must have studied. Now, at the end of the discussion, Janaka is there. Janaka is also equally learned, enlightened person. About Janaka, it is said, he was ruling over a big kingdom, but he was not worried about anything. So, how a Vedanti practices mindfulness? You can see in this episode related to King Janaka. Remember, he was a king, a busy man. He was a ruling monarch. He was not sitting in meditation somewhere. But he had attained what is called Videha Mukti or Jivan Mukti. Videha Mukti comes after death, but he already attained Jivan Mukti. When you live in this world, you're already living, you can be enlightened. Buddha was a good example. He was living in this world, preaching, and he was enlightened. So Janaka was sitting in his court one day. Suddenly some people came and announced, see, your capital, your palace is on fire. And some of the neighboring houses also on fire. So immediately all the courtiers who did not have much wealth to lose, they rushed to save their belongings. But Janaka was sitting quiet. Of course, he made arrangements for putting out the fire. He was not irresponsible as a king, but he was totally unperturbed. All others worried. They rushed to protect whatever little belongings they had in their homes. So, Mithilayam Pradagdhayam Name Kastit Pranashyadi. So Janaka made this announcement, statement in this court. Like Mithila burned, I am not going to lose anything. So remember, this should not be misunderstood. As a king, like the Roman Emperor Nero playing a guitar when the Rome was under fire. Not that. Should not misunderstand. Janaka is well known for his great active habits. He was a caring king, took care of the welfare of the people. He was so active and successful as a monarch. But Janaka thought, well, nothing belongs to me. At the same time, he made all arrangements to protect the city from fire. Others were perturbed, lost their minds. Now, that's what happens when you become a Jivan Mukta. In Vedanta, it's called, you are liberated, still you are not inactive, but nothing bothers you. So this is the characteristic of an enlightened king, a philosopher king. You can find in Ratnavali almost similar ideas that Nagarjuna is instructing the king, Shatavahana, one of the kings of those times, who himself was a great patron of Buddhism. So you can find at the experience level, a true Buddhist, an enlightened Buddhist is the same as an enlightened Vedantin. But the path may be different. Some of the details of disciplines may be different. In Vedanta, first you have to realize what is real, what is unreal. Then you should have a sense of renunciation of the unreal. And then that naturally helps you to develop a sixfold discipline. So that is Samadhama, Uparadhi, Diksha, Shraddha, Samadhanam. In English means mental restraint, physical self-restraint, contentment, inner peace, concentration, and a sense of sanctity. All these qualities you develop when you realize there is something that really matters. Everything else is there, but maybe relatively insignificant. And then you realize a strong urge for spiritual enlightenment, mumukshutvam. And then you try to enrich your mind with spiritual ideas. You practice meditation and you become an enlightened person. So you then find, so far as actual spiritual journey is concerned, it's almost parallel, Buddhism and Vedanta. But terminology may be different. Buddhism emerged as a revolt against some of the orthodox rituals and practices that developed within Hindu society, not Hindu philosophy, casteism, and lot of social injustices that emerged in an ancient society, which is again not a homogeneous society, which was diverse. If, you know, a huge subcontinent, people of different cultural traditions, you know, they practiced in their own way. So Buddhism came as a reforming movement. So that's why Buddhist Swami Vivekananda, Dr. Radhakrishnan, Gandhi, even Annie Besant, the great Irish scholar, great patriot, including Sister Nivedita, Miss Margaret Knoll, according to them, Buddhism is a great spiritual reform movement within Hinduism. Again, you should not misunderstand. I'm not saying that Buddhism doesn't have independent existence, not at all. Absolutely no. But if you make a thorough study of the original books of Vedanta and Buddhism, you find the same spiritual journey. When an enlightened person anywhere in the world looks for a transcendental spiritual source of wisdom, then you become a Buddhist, you become a Vedantin, or you may perhaps become a Christian mystic in any tradition for that matter. When you look upon Buddhism and Vedanta as a way of spiritual journey, a journey in search of the absolute spiritual truth, then you don't find any difference. But at the same time, there is a lot of difference with regard to minor details, which could not part of our discussion right now. Those who are interested, you can listen, you can join the Zoom meeting. Every Sunday, 6 p.m., we have a ongoing class on Indian philosophical systems, the foundational texts of Indian philosophy. For the last, I think, maybe 2 months, every Sunday, we have been discussing Buddhism. And as a first school of thought that we discussed was Nagarjuna Srinivasa. Today, we are going to begin the discussion on Yogacara system. So, thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.